But his response wasted no time in trying itself out on the three of us. Boys? Boys, what would you think of our getting a housekeeper? Would she do the milking? Asked Damon, ever the cagey one. That slowed up Father only for a moment. Delineation of house chores and barn chores that might be construed as a logical extension of our domestic upkeep was exactly the sort of issue he liked to take on. Astutely put, Damon. I see no reason why we can't stipulate that churning the butter begins at the point of the cow. Already keyed up, Toby wanted to know, where's she going to sleep? Father was all too ready for this one. George and Ray have their spare room going to waste now that the teacher doesn't have to board with them. His enthusiasm really was expanding in a hurry. Now our relatives on the homestead next to ours were in the market for a lodger, a lack as unbeknownst to them as our need for a housekeeper had been to us 2 minutes ago. Lowry Hill. Father had turned back to the bold-faced little advertisement as if already in conversation with it. If I'm not mistaken, that's the cream of Minneapolis. I hated to point out the obvious, but that chore seemed to go with being the oldest son of Oliver Millerone. Father, we're pretty much used to the house must by now. It's the cooking part you say you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. He knew, we all knew, I had him there. Damon's head swiveled, and then Toby's, to see how he could possibly deal with this. For miles around, our household was regarded with something like a low fever of consternation by every woman worthy of her apron. As homestead life went, we were relatively prosperous and bad off, as it was termed at the same time. Prosperity, such as it was, consisted of payments coming in from the sale of Father's drayage business back in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. The bad-off proportion of our situation was the year-old grave marker in the Marias Cooley Cemetery. Its inscription, chiseled into all our hearts as well as the stone, read Florence Millerone, beloved wife and mother, 1874 to 1908. As much as each of the four of us missed her at other times, mealtimes were a kind of tribal low point where we contemplated whatever Father had managed to fight onto the table this time. Tovers, everyone's old favorite, he was apt to announce desperately as he set before us leftover hash on its way to becoming leftover stew. Now he resorted to a lengthy slurp of his infamous coffee and came up with a response to me, if not exactly a reply. These want ads, you know, Paul, there's always some give to them. It only takes a little bargaining. If I were a wagering man, I'd lay money Mrs. Minneapolis there isn't as shy around a cook stove as she makes herself out to be. But my index finger pinned down the five tablet bold words of the heading. The woman was in a marriage. Father patiently overrode the evidence of the newsprint, so she had to have functioned in a kitchen. With 13-year-old sagacity, I pointed out, unless her husband starved out. Hooey, every woman can cook. Paul, get out your good pen and paper. This jilted old house, and all that it holds, even empty. If I have learned anything in a lifetime spent overseeing schools, it is that childhood is the one story that stands by itself in every soul. As surely as a compass needle knows north, that is what draws me to these remindful rooms, as if the answer I need by the end of this day is written in the dust that carpets them. The wrinkled calendar on the parlor wall stops me in my tracks. It, of course, has not changed since my last time here. 1952. 5 years, so quickly passed, since the Marias Cooley School Board begged the vacant old place from me for a month while they repaired the roof of their teacherage, and I had to come out from the department in Helena to go over matters with them. What I am startled to see is that the leaf showing on the calendar, October, somehow stays right across all the years. That 1909 evening of Paul, get out your good pen and paper. The lonely teachers tacking up of something to relieve these bare walls so long after that. And my visit now, under such a changed sky of history. The slyness of calendars should not surprise me, I suppose. Passing the newly painted one-room school, our school, this morning as I drove out in my state government car, all at once I was again at that juncture of time when Damon and Toby and I, each in our turn, first began to be aware that we were not quite of our own making, and yet did not seem to be simply rewarmed tovers of our elders either. How could I, who back there at barely 13 realized that I must struggle awake every morning of my life before anyone else in the house to wrest myself from the grip of my tenacious dreams, be the offspring of a man who slept solidly as a railroad tie? And Damon, fists up Damon, how could he derive from our peaceable mother? Ready or not, we were being introduced to ourselves, sometimes in a fashion as hard to follow as our father's reading finger. Almost any day in the way stations of childhood we passed back and forth between, prairie homestead and country school, was apt to turn into a fresh puzzle piece of life, something I find true even yet. It is Toby, though, large-eyed prairie child that he was, whom I sensed most as I slowed there at the small old school with its common room and the bank of windows away from its weather side. Damon or I, perhaps, can be imagined taking our knocks from fate and putting ourselves back into approximately what we seemed shaped to be if we had started off on some other ground of life than that of Marias Cooley. But Toby was breath and bone of this place. And later today, when I must go into Great Falls to give the county superintendents, rural teachers, and school boards of Montana's 56 counties my edict, I know it will be their Tobies, their school children produced of this soil and the mad valors of homesteaders such as Oliver Millerone that they will plead for. Chapter 2. The news of our housekeeper-to-be galloped to school with us that next morning, or rather, charged ahead of Damon and me in the form of Toby, excitedly whacking his heels against the sides of his put-upon little mare, Queenie. "I bet you'll have false teeth, old Mrs. Minneapolis will," Damon announced as we rode. "Bet you a black arrowhead she does." Before I could say anything, he spat in his right hand, thrust it toward me, and invoked spit bath shake, the most binding kind there was. I was not ready to stake anything on this housekeeper matter. "You know Father doesn't like for us to bet." Damon just grinned. "Let's get a move on," I told him, "before Toby laps us." As soon as we topped the long gumbo hill at our end of the coulee, the other horseback contingents of school children loped or lolled into view from their customary directions, each family cluster as identifiable to us as ourselves in a looking glass. Toby, by racing ahead, had caught up to a dilemma. Should he go tearing off to as many troops of school comers as he could reach, or make straight for the schoolhouse and crow our news to the whole school at once? He settled for the pronovos, the newcomers who joined us every morning at the section line gate. "Izzy, Gabe, everybody." That general salutation was to Inez, riding double behind Isidore. She was in Toby's grade and sweet on him, an entangling alliance he did not quite know what to do with. "Guess what?" Whatever capacity for conjecture existed in the three minimally washed faces turned our way, it surely did not stretch to the notion of domestic help. The pronovos were project people, although the distinction between those and drylanders such as us was shrinking fast. Father already was spending less time on farming, and more on hauling wares.